Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world with no interest of ever relocating to the city of Las Vegas. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we just don't like gambling enough to do that. Jordan, we have a special guest that is going to join us today for the entirety of the show. Please explain.
Yes. Hello, everybody. It is Friday. Jake and I are in Omaha in separate hotel rooms covering the College World Series. But Major League Baseball is giving us plenty to talk about, for better or for worse. Spoiler alert, it's for worse. And we wanted to bring in Chelsea Janes of the Washington Post, who joined us back at the winter meetings for a special podcast. And Chelsea was so great. She crushed the audition to randomly do another full podcast with us in June. And now she is here. Chelsea, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm always happy to be here if you have no one else. It's a good role for me.
Well, you know, we're barely paying attention to Major League Baseball, so we figured someone could come on the show and tell us what the heck is going on. What is going on is Rob Manfred is going on. Rob Manfred is kind of always going on. Like, there's never a day where people, baseball fans, wake up and they're not mad about Rob Manfred. But Big Body Rob had a particularly, we'll say, a notable press conference yesterday in which he was able to insult the A's and the gays in the span of about 30 minutes. You were there in attendance. I just want to begin about the experience of doing a Manfred press conference, right? It's usually like the same 25 people with mics in his face. I am curious about the process of knowing that he says a lot of things that are bullshit, but also having to be there every time to like ask him these questions.
It's pretty wild. And yesterday in particular was a little bit different because he said so many things so fast that I couldn't really process, that I almost didn't realize until after what had just happened. One of the things he does, you know, he walks in, he says hi to everyone very, very kind of shortly, and, you know, acknowledges all the people that he is about to kind of go back and forth with. And you can tell he's got fear in his eyes when he sees certain people, and it makes a lot of eye contact with the people he finds less threatening. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's wild. And yesterday in particular, I think I personally was like stunned into silence by some of his answers. I asked him one about what the owners thought about the A's, and that answer somehow wound its way to Oakland having not done anything to try to keep the A's. And you don't even really have to ask the right question. He just sort of tends to go where he shouldn't anyway.
Well, I want to, before we get to the specifics of yesterday's press conference, can you help us, for those unfamiliar with why the commissioner does press conferences to begin with, and what the timing and the sequence was of why he gave a press conference yesterday? Can you give a little bit of background on that?
Yeah, I think he likes to give as few as he possibly can, but he does sort of have to speak at the end of every owner's meetings, which I think they have 3 or 4 times a year, and this week had in New York. And so the last morning of the owner's meetings, as all the owners are trickling out, he brings reporters into a conference room and tells them what they talked about, or what he wants them to think they talked about. So this was just another one of those, pretty low key compared to the ones he would have during the lockout and during some of those negotiations, but always eventful somehow.
But I think that that's a very important point, like contextually, because, not to necessarily obviously defend any of the things being said, but we often talk about how, what is Rob Manfred's job and why is he kind of presenting ideas that are clearly just an extension of the owners. Well, if he's literally walking out of the owners' meetings, it should not surprise us that the talking points and a lot of the viewpoints being shared are quite literally probably directly from the voices of the most powerful men in that room, right? And so that is why, to your point, when you actually read the quotes, especially when you don't even hear them, it's shocking and stunning in some respects. But also, I'm like, yeah, duh, they just told him that 20 minutes ago. So that's the part of it that I think is compelling. So let's move forward to the specifics of yesterday, because that's the other interesting part that you just mentioned there, which is that when you are in a press conference and you don't necessarily know how he's going to react, that means that you don't even necessarily know how to react to him and how to follow up with questions, because like you said, you couldn't have necessarily foreseen him saying these things to these degrees about these certain situations. So
well, there's also a component of it, like, when you're talking to anybody in the world and they're saying things that are totally off the rails, but they're saying it with a tone that is not off the rails, and you're just kind of like nodding along like, yep, that's it. Totally. Yep, I get it. And then you like pause for a second. You're like, wait, what the fuck? Like, I imagine that's a little bit what the experience is like.
Yeah. I mean, yesterday, you know, you, I think to Jordan's point, like, that is really important. Rob Manfred has to speak for the owners. So what he's saying in defense of John Fisher, maybe he doesn't agree with. You know, I'm not saying Rob Manfred is this principled guy who would have done everything differently, but John Fisher doesn't speak. So someone has to be like, no, we're doing what we did our best, whatever. But he just like continues to go one step further. And with, you know, I think everyone kind of read the comment he made about the boycott night, where he was like, you know, oh, they almost had average major league crowd, like, good for them kind of thing. And it was like, what? Like, did you mean to say something that mean for no reason? You know, it was just kind of like, what are we doing? So yeah, a lot of moments yesterday where I was like, am I misunderstanding something? You know, let alone trying to follow up and be like, wait, did you really just say that?
Well, and also with him, because he is such a, shall we say, interesting public speaker, the quotes, when you read them, are sometimes way worse or not as bad as you think when you watch the clip. Like, he is a great example of sometimes it's worse or not. Anyway, I want to stick on Oakland first. Let's stick one topic at a time here, because something you just mentioned there, John Fisher doesn't speak. This is kind of an existential baseball issue that we have hit on a bunch since we've been doing these podcasts, which I still am constantly grappling with, which is, we want the people in charge who are making these decisions that impact, you know, millions of fans all the time to be accountable and to at least say why they're doing things. But then we also have owners that say stuff and we're like, oh my God, why are you saying anything ever? So where do you fall on that spectrum, and particularly how it relates to John Fisher?
No, I often am able to not empathize, but understand the thought processes of organizations who are like, I'm not going to let my guy talk. Like, why do the Reds let anyone talk? I don't know. You know, it makes sense to me not to. The damage that they can do is far greater than it is if they stay quiet. I think the problem is that Rob Manfred is sort of that way too. You don't have a spokesperson that's going to deflect from these problems. That's just, he's not good at it. You know, it's not necessarily like something, a personal attack on Rob Manfred, to say like, you're not really a great public messenger for these guys. And so I think with that, if you had someone who was a little more believable and empathetic in that role, maybe it wouldn't feel as painful to not hear the owners talk. But he kind of leaves it out there where it's like, is this really how you feel? Or, you know, you kind of almost can't believe what Manfred's saying. So yeah, it's a problem. I get why teams don't do it. I think in this situation, it's cowardly and for Fisher not to explain himself. And I think everyone can kind of draw their own conclusions from that. If he's willing to let them do that, then, you know, we know who he is.
At least for Bud Selig, like, he was a cutie pie. I mean, you just want to like pinch his little cheeks, you know, it was like a softer face to the experience. Right. I like Bud Selig was just so grandpa energy, right? That it was like a nice face atop the horrible thing going on, that it was more digestible. Go ahead, Jordan.
Well, and the thing that I know people who have covered the game far longer than the three of us, always talk about Bud Selig is also that Bud Selig loved baseball a lot. And he was a fan through and through. And like that clearly, at least, not that he was by any means a perfect commissioner, but in the way that he communicated, and at least in the motivations and the way that he probably interacted with the owners, there was almost a more genuine motivation, seemed to be rooted in his involvement in the game, which is a lot harder to say about our current commissioner. Now go ahead,
James. I want to ask this point blank, and then we can specifically get to the A's. Chelsea James, does Rob Manfred love ball?
I don't think he does. You know, I don't think I don't think he does. And I think it shows. And that's probably why he's not super well suited to this role. You know,
he's not doing stat head searches.
No, he's not. And he's not a great.
He should be, though. He should be.
He's good at defending the owners and what they want. And I think that is why he has his job.
So the A's specific comments, there's plenty to get to. And, you know, I know you wrote a solid recap for the Washington Post, and you can see those quotes everywhere on Twitter yesterday. But it seemed to be that the two main I would say the two things that jumped out to me. One is the one you just mentioned, which is his reaction to the reverse boycott, being like, oh, wow, congrats. You got 28,000 people like all the other major league teams do all the time. OK, great. Like, I mean, if that's literally a joke, as I just referred to, if that is the kind of, you know, flippant joke or dismissal that is being shared in the owners' rooms, that is very concerning. OK, first and foremost. The second thing is regarding the actual negotiations with the city of Oakland, which people from the Oakland government, including the mayor's office, have already come out and be like, dude, we were trying. We were actively making efforts. And as the mayor said on the day that this all, you know, blew up a month and a half ago or so, we were in the middle of negotiations when they turned around and announced they were going to Las Vegas. And so how is that, or what specifically was kind of communicated by the commissioner, and how was that received in the room and then beyond?
You know, he was very clear, as you can see in the quotes, like it was never going to happen in Oakland, or they tried and Oakland wasn't going to come through. And I think people tried to ask a lot of questions about that, you know, like what was the timeline, kind of like why, you know, is Vegas a better fit if the stadium is going to be smaller? You know, people try to get at him in all these different ways. And one of the things people kept asking in literal multiple ways was, what concerns do you have about this move? And he wouldn't say. He's like, I don't know enough. I haven't read the package. I don't know. And it's like,
do the homework,
just
bro.
Come up with a better answer. Yeah, just come up with a better answer. I'm not trying to be like flippant. I don't encourage lying, but like you can just say, you know, I'm really trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's see. There's just other ways to say it. And I think to your point of like, is this the kind of thing the owners are saying behind closed doors? To me, what was so jarring about yesterday is, if this is the kind of thing Rob Manfred doesn't think twice about saying publicly, what does he think twice about saying publicly? You know, like what is in, you know, it's just disappointing. It's disheartening. But I think it's also illuminating that like, this is who he is. This is who they are. This is who the owners are. This is how they think about it. If they can say this stuff this easily, they clearly really believe it and don't worry about it. And I think that that informs you in a different way.
And there is an element of it to me that is refreshing in a bizarre, yeah, backwards kind of end of the Watchmen way, right? Where this is the truth. We very rarely hear the quiet part out loud in our society and in this game. And when Manfred comes out and says it, and you're like, holy crap, I can't believe you said it, it is at least reassuring that our concerns about how the sport is stewarded are like founded in truth. They are grounded, yeah, in something real, right? I want to talk about this one quote. June Lee, friend of the show, tweeted this one out. And this was on like the reverse boycott. Just quote, I mean, it was great. It is great to see what is this year almost an average Major League Baseball crowd in the facility for one night. That's a great thing. So when you see this written, it comes across so bitchy, like Mean Girls level. Ooh, congratulations on your big game, right? Like that's how it reads. Did it come across that sarcastic and snappy in person or no?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I mean, to the point, like I said, I have heard it and I was like, I must have misunderstood that. But I think one of the things about Manfred, and I don't think this lets him off the hook, but it's just true, is like, he's just like this, you know, like he got to this job by being a kind of very litigious guy who is able to make good arguments and stick with them and act like it's obvious to everyone and should be that he's right. I mean, I was listening to the bankruptcy hearing about Sinclair a couple weeks ago and he was testifying and like the judge was like telling him to stop talking. Like he's the same guy in every room, you know, it's not just us. And I think that's just kind of like you said, it's a little refreshing. You're just like, okay, this is who this guy is. We don't have to wonder, you know, he's going to pretend that the A's had a choice, but even he knows that's not true. It's like, it's who he is. So you kind of have that guy at the top. He's like the dictator that everyone kind of just works around. And I just think it's almost helpful sometimes to understand how clinical his approach to this is.
What's interesting about it to me, right, one of the big things on his plate is the expansion, right, is he wants to add two more teams, but he's said like a bazillion times he's not going to do that until they remedy the A's and the Rays stadium situations. And so he wants the A's situation fixed for whatever the hell that means, right? Is he happy about this outcome where we're at now of the A's moving to Las Vegas? Because it is clearly what John Fisher wanted. And to a point, Manfred has to protect and back up those wishes of the owners. But Like, is Manfred happy with how everything went down, do you think? Or does he just not care and he's just happy with the end of the story?
I will be interested. It's hard to answer, but I will be interested to see how Oakland is treated moving forward in those expansion talks, because I think that will tell us a lot about how Manfred actually feels. You know, I think MLB is going to be happy to be in Vegas. Informally, I think that they, you know, have heard that they want to do, you know, some more events there. It's kind of a glitzy place, maybe some award shows in the, you know, it's just kind of like a place that they can use, that they know players will come to and want to be, whatever. But long term, like, I am curious if Rob Manfred genuinely believes baseball in Oakland is not viable, because if he does, he's probably really happy. Or if he thinks that baseball in Oakland with John Fisher as the owner of that team was never going to happen, so let's just get rid of that and we'll start over. I think that will inform us more than anything I've heard so far, because it's all just, he's just so hard to kind of to understand.
I think, and by the way, like, there's a lot of other elements to this A story right now. I know that it seems like it's pretty much passed all the bills it needs to pass in the Nevada state government. So now we're going to go to the relocation committee, whatever that looks like. I don't know how long that process is going to be. I know Bryce Harper had some interesting quotes as the prince of you know, Vegas baseball, talking some, doing some, finding a way to pander to Phillies fans even through that.
I talked to Bryson Stott, also from Vegas, about this like a couple months ago when it really first came out, and he was like, I don't think it will work. He like straight up was just like, I think it's a bad idea, because the people of Vegas don't want something that isn't theirs, which is in kind of an interesting mentality. I would imagine that growing up in Vegas, like, there's a lot of hate thrown at you, like fake town, whatever. And so like picking up someone else's thing is probably, you know, embarrassing.
I suppose you're saying compare it to if they had gotten an expansion team instead of a relocated team. Yeah. Yeah, that makes some sense to me. And again, like, I've said this at the early part of this process, I understand the inclination to just dunk on Vegas as a sports place, and like, that's, I get it. I don't really feel the need to do that. Like, I don't feel like that is the story here at all at this point. Like, I really want to keep the focus on Oakland, but yeah, it is still part of it, and we're putting those people in a weird situation of, you know, the way that Seattle feels about Oklahoma City, truly, right? From an NBA standpoint, like, that is, there is a lot of vitriol there, and the people of Oklahoma City had nothing to do with that, but that is it. It's all about the owners and then who moved them there in the first place. I want to get to the other topic, which, listen, here we are, June 16th. And I was like, all right, how many other ways can Major League Baseball screw up Pride Month? We're only halfway through, and how can we do it? Well, good news. We got some new. We managed to, you know, DFA our shitty pitchers saying dumb shit, but we still have to keep going with some really inspiring and maddening stuff. So let's flip the topic there. Of course, the A's story will continue, and we will continue to cover it to the best of our ability. But I did want to talk about this as well, because it feels important. And as you kind of communicated on your timeline yesterday, Chelsea, this, it to some ways was almost even more stunning to kind of hear said out loud in some respects. So why don't you take us through about how this line of questioning kind of came up yesterday during the meeting? I'm curious about that too, in relation to the A's. I'm curious how he was asked about Pride Night and Pride Month in MLB, and then kind of how he responded to that.
Yeah, I think there had been a story in the Washington Examiner, I think, yesterday morning, that MLB had kind of quietly told teams not to do Pride uniforms or whatever. I actually hadn't seen that at the time. I don't know if Hannah Kaiser, who asked Manfred about the Pride Nights, had seen it, but she, I think, in light of all the craziness in Pride Month, was basically like, did you guys have any conversations lately about, you know, standardizing how teams handle this, you know, having everybody do it, whatever. And so that's the question that got the answer. And the answer was, he volunteered that story that some of us might not have seen was correct, that MLB had indeed told teams, we don't think you should put Pride logos on uniforms, hats, bases, whatever. And he said the reason is because he wants to protect players from potentially having to do things that are, like, you know, against their personal views, was what he said. And he said that, and we all kind of heard him. And then the press conference ended, and even in the immediate aftermath, we all were like, wait, what? And I think that's kind of the comment that's been circulating since, is basically we need to protect the players from pride logos.
And when he says protect the players, would he, this is like a dynamic I'm always interested with him and with MLB, is how much are you trying to solve a problem and how much are you trying to solve a PR problem? How much are you trying to avoid something messy that you then need to deal with? And this is definitely the latter, because players are not people in this scenario who need the protecting, the first thing. And who is Rob Manfred to say that he is out there to protect the interests of the players to begin with? We just did the lockout where he was going against the interests of the players. And so that particular excuse rings hollow besides all the other insane shit that he's saying in regards to this, right?
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, you know, one of the narratives around pulling the All-Star game from Atlanta was that MLB didn't want Black players getting asked about this for the months leading up to the game and didn't want them having to choose until it wanted to make a decision for them and protect them from that. That makes sense to me. That is a kind of protection that makes sense. This is not. I think what he means, and to your point, is like, we need to avoid the PR problem that would emerge if a bunch of dudes said we're not wearing these uniforms, because every time it happens, people get mad. And I think the fact, you know, one of the things that kind of struck me yesterday is, you know, it's really easy for Rob Manfred to say something else, to say, we don't really like people messing with our uniforms. And we know Major League Baseball is insane about that stuff. So, you know, we don't want to like kind of have pride uniforms every year. We're just going to leave that, whatever. We can only have so many new uniforms, whatever. Stupid, but fair. But he went further and said, no, we don't do this because some players might decide it is against their beliefs to say gay people should be welcome in Major League Baseball. And we need to protect their right to believe that. And I think, and protect them from any repercussions from believing that. And to me, that's just, you basically are saying that's more important than making people feel welcome. And, you know, you're saying that those are reasonable views that these players deserve to have held without being questioned about them. And I think that is a hard thing for a lot of people to hear who are genuinely in need of protection, who are marginalized and who look to the sport for escape and see that it will not stand up for them.
And also, like, what is the basic level of messaging around pride in the first place? Baseball for all, right? Baseball is for everybody, for you, for whoever, in whatever, you know, community you put yourself in. Who is baseball for?
Just quickly, yeah. Jordan, that is not true. Like, I think that is important. I'm not saying that you're not saying that. I'm just saying, like, when MLB or when Pride Nights or with anything, when we're saying, like, the stadium is a place that everyone should feel comfortable, that is not the reality right now on June 16th, 2023. And, like, I just think that is a really important thing to recognize.
100%. The reason I'm saying that is that is the stated intention. That is the stated goal that we are trying to get to. And what these quotes are literally saying out loud is actually baseball is more for these people whose opinions we are more concerned about, even if they are the majority and they are the ones who are, as you've already talked about in recent episodes about some of the discourse around these issues, the people who are already in charge and the people who are already the majority, the people who are not necessarily threatened or marginalized and all these other things, right? We've already had those conversations. But that's what's so stunning about it, is it is the antithesis of what is the stated mission of everything here. And while we cannot expect every single team to have the same level of Pride Night, depending on where they, I mean, it would be nice, right? It'd be cool if we had some level. I'm curious where you stand on that, but also the degree to which there should be some sort of league mandated Pride Night or Pride Month and events like that. That I sort of understand. I wish there was, but I can see that more. But again, it's the way that this is being communicated and the motivations and the concerns that are being said out loud that is what is so jarring, I think, is the fair way to put it.
Well, also, sorry, just when you look at it within the context of wearing other themed uniforms for like military days, where that is, you know, changing the way a uniform looks in order to promote or highlight a certain group or people or community in the country, that is like, how is that okay and no pride uniforms is okay, right?
It's it's really wild because I think one of the things that comes up again here, as with the A's, is like, if you're willing to say this out loud without hesitation, you probably are even further behind on your empathy than you've communicated. You know, it just shows. And I think it's really hard. Like, we all have to sort of like learn how to put ourselves in other people's shoes and understand why things hurt them and why things are hurtful to certain communities. Like, I'm sure you guys, I've certainly like made mistakes in that way where I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that that would be hurtful. But we've had this conversation for years now. And for the commissioner of Major League Baseball not to be prepared to deliver that message differently, to sort of A, volunteer it. No one asked, did you say don't do Pride Night? You know, he just said it. I think it just reveals just this level of removal of him and the people around him from, I don't know, what's hurtful to these people. And it's disappointing. Like you say, we all understand, like, these are conservative owners, a lot of conservative players. Like, you don't expect Major League Baseball to be the front runner on LGBTQ rights, right? But for them to admit that they are protecting the rights of their employees to say, I don't think gay people should be welcome, and I am so bothered by it that I won't wear this jersey, that is kind of rough. And it's something they could easily change and make a stand on. And they not only choose not to, they tell you they're not even close.
And the thing that I find incredibly disheartening about this, in a way, it gives Anthony Bass and the Tampa relievers a big victory and a win where they feel like worthy martyrs, like brave souls who stood up for what they believed in, and they are able to, that just reinforces that behavior within the league and will only lead to more players feeling comfortable sharing their regressive beliefs in public. And that will only create more harm for the marginalized people who don't already feel comfortable. And to me, more than Rob Manfred saying something stupid, like, again, he does that all the time. Like, that is what I find so sad about this, is that he is basically saying, people stood up for the thing you believed in and it worked. Right. And that's just going to become a cycle now.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it gets messy when you bring in religion, and certainly we are able to let everyone have their religious beliefs. I think what it comes down to in this conversation, as in many outside of baseball, is, you know, if your beliefs hurt people, you would hope that that would lead you to reconsider. And when the employer or Major League Baseball, this massive institution, says like, that view is not okay, we're going to encourage people to feel welcome, you deal with that, that probably would make some people reconsider, or at least expose them as what they are. And the fact that they can't do that, it just gives people the right to, you know, think they're in the right. And that's hard.
I mean, listen, there's I'm sure a lot of us coming out of that presser that we could have dug deep on, but I think we should take a break. Thank you for helping recap that with us, Chelsea. But Chelsea's going to stick around. She's going to join us for the second half of this show, which we are excited about. We are going to talk some real ball, as much as this league makes us not want to. And so we are going to take a quick break. And when we return, we are going to talk about the misery in Missouri.
This is former PGA Tour winner Smiley Kaufman, host of The Smiley Show, a SiriusXM podcast. You want to know what I love about golf? I get to talk to some really cool people. I get to walk the fairways of the best courses in the world with the best players in the world, and I get to share it with you every single week. Listen to The Smiley Show right now on Stitcher, Pandora, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Smiley, S-M-Y-L-I-E.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Chelsea Janes of the Washington Post continues to join us. What a treat. We are now going to enjoy talking about baseball. And what better way to enjoy that than talking about the last place St. Louis Cardinals. Chelsea, we're going to talk about the state of Missouri here for a little bit. The Royals are the worst team in baseball. The Cardinals are the worst team in baseball that is not supposed to be bad. And let's begin with the Cardinals, because I saw you tweeting about them a little bit over this past week as they have continued to spiral for like the fourth different time this season in a different way. And so let's just, you know, send it to you here. I know you kind of expressed this in your tweets, but just like, where do you, to what degree are you shocked? What has surprised you? What is your takeaway? I don't know if you've been around the Cardinals much this season, but what do you take from this just complete mess, completely unprecedented situation for a franchise that can roll out of bed and win 90 games?
Yeah, I was around them a bit during all the Wilson Contreras stuff, so at another spiral point. And so first of all, I think like there's a team every year, every couple years that's supposed to be really good and falls apart. I watched the Nats do it. It's painful. It's agonizing. The vibes change and you can't get out of it. Like, that's kind of what makes baseball great, is there's an emotional component that you kind of can't measure. And the Cardinals are just in their heads. Like, you can see it. You can feel it walking in that room. I think, you know, I still think, like, I thought they would be really good. You know, I really did. And it's sort of hard to imagine that they stay here forever. But it's also hard to imagine that after all they've been through, you know, they just kind of turned around. Like, Nolan Arenado was there the other day, like, defending the coaching staff, but kind of sounding like someone died. Like, you know, they're feeling it. And it's too bad. I think Ollie Marmol's a really interesting manager and a smart guy who's really kind of got a different approach than a lot of people. But who knows if he can survive this. It's just one of those things where it's, like, hard to pinpoint fault, but somebody's going to have to take the blame. And I'm very curious to see who it will be.
Before we get into the why, I just want to talk about the Ollie Marmol press conference experience, which reads like an SNL bit at times, where he is asked a question and he answers it with as few words as he possibly can.
Yep.
And there is this dumb pact, right, that we have as sports writers that in some ways I'm happy Marmol is like pushing back against, where if you ask a question that sucks, the manager or the interview subject is expected to expand on that totally. Question and provide you with the quote you need for your story. Right. And so he does not play that game. Right. So I think the other day he was asked, like, you know, was it tough how in the bottom of the 10th you had some big bats coming up and, you know, they couldn't get the job done? Is it frustrating? And Ollie Marmol goes, yes. Where
yes. And I having been in these because to call them, it's different because sometimes, especially at home, it's more of a he's up on the podium. Whereas on the road, I've seen this in over the past couple of years in Cincinnati, he's just in his office. He's just in his office sitting at his desk. And especially on the road, like literally, it was me, it was Derek Gould, and it was John Denton from MLB.com. And it went 20 minutes, but like Derek just desperately trying, and Derek's the best, right? But like desperately trying to pull anything, and Ollie will not give. And in some points, Ollie's practically smiling and laughing. Now, he's not doing as much of that anymore now because the season is getting to a point where it is no longer remotely probably salvageable. And this was probably a month ago where things were bad, but it was like, we're fine. We're only 5 games back, but now you're the worst team in the National League and you can't really smile through any of it, even if you are giving short answers. So I agree with you. He is a fascinating manager. And I don't even know if we're ever going to find out if he's good or bad because it's kind of too far gone. Like I don't, and, but to your point, like who is it his fault? No, there's no way it's his fault. But so then what's the problem? Because I still look at this roster. I'm like, damn, that's a lot of good players. There's a lot of good players on this team, some of them who are still playing pretty well.
Someone in a meeting at some point in a Zoom meeting made a presentation. I don't know this for a fact. This is conjecture. Made a presentation that was like, everyone wants pitchers who strike people out. We should get a great defense and pitchers who don't strike anybody out. And that is a market inefficiency. And that person either had enough juice or made a compelling enough argument to convince the powers that be to do this. And then they did it. And it worked for a couple of years because they had an elite defense. And then this year in 2023, the entire thing fell off a cliff. And so in my mind, that is the person on whom the blame should be. Either the person who came up with this idea, the person who continued to do this strategy, or John Mozeliak, the general manager, who is the one pressing the final button. Like, it is such an obviously bad idea. Like, and I know it worked, but the defense has just cratered to such an extent that, like, this is not a bad lineup. You know, they've underperformed, but they are good. Like, they're still pretty good. Like, I believe in the lineup. The defense sucks and the pitching sucks. And that's why they're here.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch. I asked Miles Michaelis about that, like, you know, the ground balls and the shift. And he was like, you know, I think we've been really unlucky this year and all this stuff. And, you know, unluckier than most. And the balls will bounce the other way. And it's like, but what if they don't, you know? And I think they're all starting to, like, have that realization. But there's, you know, and I don't know the organization as well as I, you know, like, do others. But there's been some weirdness there the last few years with Mike Schilt and, you know, Jeff Albert, and just kind of the way things have shuffled, Mike Maddox leaving, whatever. It just doesn't seem like a place where there's a coherence of mission. And on a team where they're so obsessed with the Cardinals way and doing that, it's almost, you kind of wonder if maybe it's time to kind of get some new blood in there at the top and sort of remedy the vibe. I don't know if it's John Mozeliak's fault. I often think that sometimes just change for change's sake is helpful in these situations. So who knows, but it is, things have been weird there for a bit. And I think you're right. Like, there's been some strategies settled on there that you're kind of like, do you just think you're smarter than everyone else? And I think they do. And in many cases they have been, but it's kind of fallen apart and they may need to kind of humble themselves a little bit here.
Yeah. And Mozeliak's had so much success to where it's hard to put it on him. But to your point, the timing was weird because the whispers over the last few years is that he's kind of on his way out and it still seems that way. But instead of, you know, jumping ship like Theo before everything gets ugly, he's riding it out. Like, he's still there. And I don't know what – it doesn't seem like it's likely to keep him around for much longer. That's for sure. We'll see how that – but again, as with a lot of things with organizational stuff like this, as Jake's kind of alluding to, we don't totally know. There's deep-seated stuff here within the clubhouse, within just player development in general at all levels of the minor leagues, combined with the analytics and the way that they've built this roster, that is, there's a lot of things contributing. This is, you cannot just point to one player, to one coach, to one move. As much as we want it, it's easy to be like, oh my God, like Wilson Contreras was their one move and that's been a disaster. And this is all that, like, and they got, you know, they got complacent because their division is an embarrassment. And by the way, that's still true. That is still true. And they are in, they have the worst record in the National League. So it's wild. It's wild. So let's go from them to Kansas City. I don't know how much you've thought about this team, Chelsea, if at all, if you've seen them, if you've watched a minute of them this season, because if you haven't, I totally understand. But what has happened over the last week and a half has been, or two, 3 weeks, has basically been an unbelievable nosedive from being the clear second worst team to, in combined with the improbable A's winning streak, being the worst team in baseball for a team that I don't think was expecting to be good this year, but was at least expecting to be fun and sort of cheeky, you know? All right, we got some young pieces. We have, you know, Bobby Witt Jr. and Vinny Pasquantino. And I think
that
Vinny
was my, being up for the year. When I was single, those couple of years in New York, that was my Hinge profile, was fun and sort of cheeky.
Fun and sort of cheeky,
not
yes.
Good. Not good. Fun and sort of cheeky.
And it led you back to your high school girlfriend. So you can see how that worked out for Kansas City.
Wow, that is an oversimplification of my relationship journey. But thank you, Jordan Schusterman.
You brought us there unexpectedly, so I had to bring us back. Kansas City is horrible. They have, and Vinny Pasquantino being out for the year with labrum surgery, their only good hitter, basically. I mean, Sal Perez has been honestly awesome, and I love Sal Perez. But from your bird's eye view as a national reporter who probably isn't watching them every day, I mean, this is shocking. And when you look at kind of also organizationally, the way where Dayton Moore moves out, but Piccolo, who's been there the whole time, just steps right in, that was already mildly concerning when you consider, to your point, sometimes change is what you need and it's just change. I don't care what it is, just get something new. This is a dark, they're in a dark place. And Royals fans, I feel bad for them because rebuilds shouldn't take this long because we've seen other teams, you can get out of this if you are good at team building and you're good at player development, even if you're not spending that much money. Doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon for Kansas City. What have been your takeaways from the Royals?
Yeah, I have not watched them a ton, but I have kind of paid attention. You know, the Andy McCullough factor of him tweeting about the Royals every few weeks. Some Royals great. I go back and see how they're doing. But yeah, it's interesting because one of the things that was really clear to me for years with them is that they were just whiffing on pitching prospects. Like, I don't know if they were whiffing on draft or development. So when you know, they like you said, they've got some hitters. They've shown that they can kind of, I guess Bobby Witt Jr. was a no-brainer, but they didn't mess him up. but you know, what's happened on that side for them? And then to your point, if you keep the kind of same regime in place, like, is it going to change? And they're not a team that has like all this money to throw into R&D and build pitching labs at every minor league facility. Like, they've got to figure this out, you know, on a budget and with people who have not proven they can't. So it's rough and it's bleak and they definitely deserve better. And I know they're trying to get a stadium, and it's just kind of, it's just that familiar situation of like, how are you going to get out of this? And I think the answer is they've got to figure out how to develop pitching. And there are a lot of other teams that can say that too.
The concerning thing for Royals and Royals fans, right, is from 1996 to 2013, this team did not finish above third place in the division. Again, 96 to 2013. That's almost 20 years. They were in that spiral of, it's like when we were growing up, perpetually bad. They were always bad. There was never like a refresh. There was never a rebuild that seemed like it was going to work. It was just this static sludge of just disgusting baseball. And it does seem like they are being pulled back into that because this current core, the Bobby Witts and the Vinnies, like, it's not going to be enough. There, that is what has been so dispiriting about this season, is that there was hope. And not only is this season not gone well, it has shown that this group is unlikely to be the group that brings them back to where they need to go. And you see that all the time with various, you know, rebuilds, when it becomes clear that, like, I'm trying to think, like, the rebuild before the Cubs got good, where it was like Josh Vitters, right? It was like, oh, he's going to save us. Like, he's going to, and then you come to this realization that that's not the case, right? And it's so disheartening because you've spent all this time as a fan believing in these prospects and looking at high A box scores and, you know, and then the guys suck, or they don't suck, but they're just not enough. And I think you're like, I don't want to put too much pressure or blame on Vinny and Bobby Witt and Melendez. Like, it's the pitching. You're right. Like, the fact that they haven't been able to develop pitching internally, despite drafting, like, what was it, Jordan? Like 85 college arms in the 2018
and
draft.
And even two years ago, like when those guys were first getting to the big leagues, it looked like an accomplishment. It looked like, oh my God, like they actually, yeah, this has paid off, because sometimes not all those guys get to the big leagues. But now, and this is why this is so dire, you look at where their system is and it's terrible. And they do have a very strong pitching staff in A ball, with some guys they've recently drafted.
Congratulations.
But like, Ace Lacy is not.
Raise yeah, the banner. Raise the banner. Exactly. Strong pitching like, staff and A-ball.
Ace Lacy hasn't thrown a pitch this season. Like, he was a top five pick. And Bobby Wood Jr., who, I'm not going to quit him because he still could go 30-30 this year, which is so funny. Like, I mean, like he went 20-30 last year. It was like the worst 20-30 season of all time. But like, I'm not, Bobby Wood Jr., I'm not burying. It's frustrating
Bobby
that
Wood
he's
Jr.,
not better.
Bobby Wood Jr. is like late career Russell Westbrook level of athlete.
Yeah, where, but he's 23.
I know. So it's like incredibly watchable, except we all know that he's not good right now, right? Like, we accept both of those facts to be true.
So, but to Chelsea's point, like, the pitching is just, like, the fact that Brady Singer has been downright horrific this year is both disappointing and surprising. Like, if you had told me that Lynch and, you know, Bubich was looking good before he got hurt, but some of these other guys, if you told me they weren't working out, okay. But that's the one where I just don't know. And then the saddest part is, it's like, their best trade chip is Aroldis Chapman. And I guess they could say it's Sal Perez, and I just don't think they're going to do that, but maybe I'm wrong. But it sucks. It sucks. It sucks for them. And I've said this a lot, but just watching these four rebuilds in the Central, Pirates, Reds, Royals, Tigers, and how bad it's going for the Royals and Tigers, and how well, relatively, it's going for the Reds and Pirates is pretty stunning to watch. And yeah, but hey, Spencer Torkelson, maybe it's happening. Maybe it's happening. All right, we're not talking about the Tigers. All right, let us spend 2 to 4 minutes saying holy shit about Shohei Ohtani. I would say that this is not something we do nearly enough on this podcast, but also, like, you know, it's not like you need to convince us. He's the best player in the world. He's the best baseball player I've ever seen. What he did this week, hitting 4 opposite field home runs, 3 of them were 440 feet or farther. The farthest balls hit to the left field in ballpark history, all 3 of them by him, including in a game where he was pitching. I mean, you know, we're out of words. He's the best player I've ever seen. Chelsea, what do you think? What do you think about this guy? He's pretty good, right?
I mean, those home runs, you guys were tweeting them over and over. So I've like watched them a bunch. And I mean, they're just absurd. Like there's not people that can do that. The only thing I've seen that's like comparable to that kind of like opposite field alley power is like Juan Soto at his absolute best. And that was something like no one had seen before in the Nationals organization. You know, it's just like, it doesn't happen. Like, and Ohtani's unbelievable. I mean, even like WBC batting practice sessions where he was just purposely putting balls in the top deck in Miami. Like people don't do that. People can't do that accidentally. So yeah, he's amazing. And actually last night was the first time I let myself be like, is this going to happen? Like, are the Angels good enough?
Interesting.
I don't know, but the vibes are better this time of the year than they usually are there. So I don't know.
Last night was the first time that I thought, oh, he actually can singularly carry them, yes. Which I know that sounds dumb, but like, because he has done this for the last few years, but like this stretch, this one he just did in Texas this week, it actually felt like a one-man team. Like, as we've mentioned a couple times, Mike Trout has been actively bad for like a month. And I know that they have built this roster up to be a much more competent team. And I do think they are going to be in the mix for a wild card no matter what. But like, I'm with you. It's like, holy shit, he can just win these games on his own. And to be able to hit these home runs, I mean, this is what I tweeted, but it's just like, if he never pitched, he would be one of the most astonishing position players that we have in the game. And he pitches. So pretty fucking cool.
It's amazing.
He's good, guys.
Well, can I say one more thing about Ohtani and this hot streak in particular? He also, in May, was kind of going through it. Like, he had a little run in May where he was striking out a shit ton. And, like, at the end of April. And then now it's like, I mean, he's got, like, a 1,400 OPS in June or some fucking ridiculous nonsense. So, yeah. Anyway, it's just funny because we really have not talked about it much on this podcast. This week demanded it.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I have 2 points here. One is like, okay, why do we not talk about him maybe enough on this podcast? I think it's because there is a lazy level of analysis that happens around the baseball media world where it just like Ohtani go brr is the totality of what people say. And so it is sometimes difficult to add anything more than that because of how obvious his excellence is on a day-to-day basis. And I don't want that to like make us numb to him or, you know, not appreciate him enough. But I sometimes find it difficult to talk about Ohtani in that way because it's like, what do you see? Just like, I don't need, no one is listening to this podcast to be like, I wonder if Ohtani's good. Like, any person can watch him and understand like 80% of Shohei Ohtani being incredible without anyone providing any level of analysis.
Totally agree. But again, that is why I did want to harp on that, at least when he did it the first time and then three more times over the course of the week. That specific home run, I just can't. He did it three times in 1 week. I cannot. It just does not look normal at all. Well, I it is so ridiculous to see opposite field power like that.
Because we have a conception in our heads of what an opposite field home run looks like, where a batter swings with a certain amount of force and then the math of how far the ball should go and to where is in our heads. And for Soto, as you mentioned before, when he does it, he is swinging so hard and the transfer of power is so visually apparent that like when he hits an opposite field home run, you're like, oh my God, that's going to go far. Ohtani, it's just like, zing, like third deck.
The trajectory looks like he's pulling the ball. That shouldn't be possible. Like that, and it's the same thing with Soto. Like when you watch the Soto home run of the train tracks in the World Series, like it, that should not be possible to do opposite field. And Ohtani did it three times in the same week while pitching.
Last thing on the Angels, really quickly. Yeah. I want to have a longer conversation about them next week, Jordan, because I do think they're interesting, and I do think that this is a different year for the Angels. Yes, they are in a place they've been before, but the fact that they have built a higher floor for this roster that has allowed for Trout to be bad and for them still to be here is notable, I think. I want to get to it next week. The last thing I will say about them, in order, the top four players by wins above replacement for the Anaheim Angels: Shohei Ohtani, 4.6. This is BREF. Mike Trout, 2. Zach Neto, 1.9. Mickey Moniak, 1.5. Go Angels.
And Chris Davinsky, by the way, at number 6. So there's still problems here. Okay, this is, there is not, to your point, Chelsea. You know, it's easy to get tricked. It's happened to most of us. But let's be patient. Let's just enjoy the show. No W. All right, it's time for the good, the bad, the ugly. We can speed through these, but I'm so excited about this because Chelsea is especially equipped to participate, as you will find out here shortly. So Chelsea, thank you for indulging us. As always, we do on Friday. Something good, something bad, something ugly from the past week or perhaps from 2015. Let us go to you, Jake. Start us off with something good.
I want to talk about Kevin Kiermaier as my good. He has not been particularly good recently. He's kind of coming back to earth a little bit offensively. But he is enjoying the single best season of his career as an aged 33, injury-riddled center fielder who was just booted from the only team he'd ever known. And he's been incredible. Kiermaier has never been an all-star, which is indicative of how we think about value and defense. And Jarrelton Simmons was never an all-star. The elite defensive players, because they don't have like incredible defensive seasons that are obvious to our eyes, don't get the opportunity to be all-stars. And I think Kiermaier is going to get that chance this year because of how good he's been offensively. And for me, that is good. He is a really iconic player. He is someone that I will like tell my children about and have them watch highlights of him. He is as good of a defensive center fielder. He is the Andrew Jones of like our generation of following ball, like the last decade. He is that guy. He does not, like, he was not on a famous team necessarily, or he was not as good offensively, and he did not have big postseason moments like Andrew Jones or whatever. But Kiermaier is the best defensive center fielder of our generation. I'm happy he's finally getting some of his flowers. I wrote a thing over at Fox Sports this past week where I asked Kiermaier for his three pillars, like his three commandments of how he plays center field defense. And it was really interesting to hear him talk. Like, he was like, the first thing, I am ready every pitch. The level of intensity with which he speaks about center field defense was really enlightening to me. He was like, anytime there's a pitch from a pitcher, I assume I'm like robbing a home run. You know what I mean? And that psycho behavior is part of why he's so good. So for me, Kevin Kiermaier is good. I will kick it to you, Chelsea. What was good for you this week?
I'm going to be a homer here and just bring up something no one cares about outside of DC, which is, I think Mackenzie Gore might be the real deal.
Five
plus innings against the, I mean, the Astros are weaker than normal, but he just kind of keeps putting up numbers. His you know, his whiff percentages and stuff are like, they're not top, but they're close enough that you kind of have to give it a second look and be like, is this real? And one of the things that's kind of hard to see from afar that I've gotten to see more up close is like, that guy's a dude, as you would say. Like, he's got the factor of like, he's mad if he's not good. He thinks he should be good all the time. You know, a lot of young pitchers have come up during my time in DC, and some of them have been really, really good. But he is the one who I look at first, and I see like that fire that you only kind of seem to see in the really good ones. And it's been interesting to watch, but I think it's been really encouraging for the Nats. Like, to your point of the Royals not getting to see the kind of progress they were hoping for, I think the Nats are looking at Gore and just being like, stay where you are, dude. Like, keep going. Let's keep going, because this is where you're supposed to be. So quietly, I think he's sort of becoming what they are hoping.
The Nats are saying to their pitching dev people, don't talk to him. Don't say anything to him.
Just leave him alone. We don't know why this is happening. Just let him go.
And JoJo Gray has also been pretty freaking solid. Awesome. So both of them. But awesome. I'm glad you mentioned Gore. I think it got kind of lost because he had some like disaster outings and then got hurt. He had a 1.5 ERA through his first 9 major league starts last year before the trade. Like, it was happening. It was like, holy shit, like, this is the guy. This is the dude who was one of the more celebrated, you know, amateur pitching prospects we've ever seen. So, great shout out. He is, he's a fun watch, too, as far as left-handed pitchers. It's nice, you know, if you have to watch Patrick Corbin, at least you're going to get to also watch Mackenzie Gore in the stretch there. My good is Matt McClain. Matt McClain is so good at baseball, guys. I am such a big fan. I've gotten to watch him now since he came up with the Reds. And while Ellie De La Cruz does deserve all the attention and more, Matt McClain is just ridiculous. And also fascinating because he has been a very celebrated and people thought he was going to be a great hitter since he was 17. You know, he is a first-round pick out of high school, doesn't sign, goes to UCLA, and like has a good career there, but it wasn't like he totally blew everyone away. And since he got into pro ball, he just added a shocking amount of power for a dude who's listed at 5'8 and might be 5'7, having been around him. Just a very easy stat. Since he was called up on May 15th, he's second in baseball in hits. Not supposed to be that easy. And it's interesting because he's right behind Freddie Freeman and Bo Bichette. And Bo Bichette is like kind of an interesting comp there. I mean, he's not quite as big, and I don't think he has nearly as much raw power, but it's more than I thought. And he's a great defender, great base runner. And that is a foundational piece for Cincinnati. He is the real deal. I'm a huge fan of Matt McClain. So there you go. He is good. Chelsea, let's send it back to you, actually, for some bad.
My bad is more like perplexing. And I think it is the Buck Showalter approach to the Mets' recent struggle.
Love this.
This is kind of my Ugla, but we will get there.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, good. Shoot. Okay, good. Sorry.
No, go.
I'll be quick. My assumption with Buck Showalter is that he is always talking to the media with a strategy. That guy is always trying to deflect from players or whatever. But he's been kind of angry this week. Like, he's been like, no, I'm like, we have, you know, nothing to be ashamed of or whatever he said after that game, and just kind of being short. And it's not what you expect from someone with that kind of experience who knows New York, who like should be able to kind of handle something like this. And I'm a little confused. I don't know if we're seeing him unravel or if he's got something in mind that he thinks this is the right way to handle it and take pressure off the players. But I had thought for sure the Mets would be okay. And watching his demeanor change a little bit and hearing people who've talked to him recently say he's just very on edge even more than usual is I think a bad sign for me, because he should know when things are going to be okay and when they're not. And he's not projecting Buck Showalter confidence right now, I would say.
I think friend of the program, Andy McCullough, said this at some point recently where it was like Buck Showalter is doing the whole 5-year Buck Showalter cycle in 2 years.
Great point. Yeah.
Like he's just accelerating the whole thing where we're already at the end of it. Right.
Yeah.
But they didn't get to win in the middle is kind of what
totally. And I've always wondered, like, you know, I've enjoyed dealing with him and looking back, you know, he's got that reputation. Like he leaves teams win. And I was like, why does that happen? And I have seen it on their accelerated scale. Like, oh, now I see. Like, I get it, you know. And I like him a lot, but it's been interesting to watch.
That is a good bad. Thank you, Chelsea, for that. Jake, what you got?
Luis Arraez is 0 for his last 12, everybody.
Oh, 12. It's a 12. It's so funny. You know how many players go 0 for 12?
Not this one.
I know. So good.
In a three-game set. In a three-game set against the Mariners, he went 0 for 12. He is one.
Look at...
Yeah, there you go, Jordan. Wow. He's one for his last 17, dating back to the last game of the White Sox series. Again, this is a very normal thing for most baseball players, but not for the one who is trying to hit 400. His average is all the way down to a microscopic 378, which would be like the highest average in the last 10 years,
right.
But is disappointing. But it is a great reminder of how cruel the math is and why hitting even 350 is impossible. Because if you go 0 for 4, like you're fucked. Like you're just fucked, right? And Luis Arraez going 1 for 17 has, like, he has to get hot for 3 weeks to get back to 400, right?
And I don't mean it from the party pooper standpoint, because I love Luis. He's one of my favorite players. And I wrote about him last year when he was hitting 360. But like, this is why the 400 conversations are just absurd, because it takes 3 bad games and you're screwed. Like, it's like, and I know he can go on a hot streak and hopefully gets it back. But Mariners raised the banner, kept Arraez hitless for a series. I mean, let's go. This is huge. This season's been a smashing success.
What's bad for you, Jordan?
The Milwaukee Brewers have lost 6 in a row. And while this division, they are injured. I acknowledge that they are injured. But a couple weeks ago, the Reds were in striking distance coming into a 4-game series at home against the Brewers. And the Brewers were like, no, it's fine. We're going to win. They won 3 of 4. And it was like, all right, sorry, Reds. That was cute. And since then, the Reds have been on fire and the Brewers are a disaster. Of course, they got swept at home by Oakland. They lose two close games, including the first Devin Williams meltdown of the year, maybe the last Devin Williams meltdown of the year against Minnesota, where I believe he did not record an out on Tuesday. And this team is just as painfully mid as it gets. And we talk about the Twins, and it's like, please just win this stupid division. Like, that's how I feel about Milwaukee. But it's more fun if Pittsburgh and Cincinnati are going to stick around. Like, I think that's way more interesting. So it's kind of good for the nature of how interesting the season is. But as far as Milwaukee's expectations, like, it's bad. It's very bad. So they are bad. All right, Ugla time. I think, Jake, you should go first.
So my Ugla was Buck Showalter related. There was a video that Yes Network tweeted out during the Subway series. Did you see this? Of Buck Showalter and a bunch of Yankees. And the title was basically like, what do these New Yorkers think about pizza? And they talked about pizza, but then it kind of just slowly fell into a conversation about New York as a whole. And they're like, you know, these clips, like, they're very short. And there's like Oswaldo Cabrera is on there being very charismatic. And, you know, Kyle Gashioka has a bad answer. And, you know, but the Buck Showalter part of it was so incredible. There are three different things that he says in there. The first is in response to pizza and his favorite pizza place in New York. And he said, my wife cooks, was his response to his favorite pizza place.
My wife cooks.
This is an outrageous statement for a variety of reasons. Number one, your wife does not have a brick oven in your home in which she can make delicious Neapolitan style pizza. That I've refused to believe that. Maybe you do in your backyard of your big house, wherever you live in the suburbs, but there is no way that your favorite pizza is my wife cooks. That's number one. Number two, your wife doesn't cook, because where do you eat every night, Buck? At the yard. That's an acceptable answer. An acceptable answer to this question for Buck, who did not want to answer the question, was, I don't live in New York City, probably. I eat at the yard. I haven't gotten the opportunity to eat at a pizza place, which is totally legitimate. And a great reminder that a lot of the players who play for the teams in these cities don't really live in the cities and are not necessarily connected to these cities as places because of how their lives work, because of how much time they spend on the road and where they live in the off season and like their weird schedules. I just think, you know, like Jake Bowers is not like experiencing New York City. You know what I mean? Like, he's probably living in New Jersey somewhere. That was the Buck Showalter's first answer. And the second one was what he likes most about New York, where he said, I don't know. I live here.
So what do you think that means? Translate that for us, Jake.
I think what he is trying to say is, I love it here. I mean, I live here, don't I? But the way it came across was like, I live here. Like, I make New York great.
Oh, I thought I was interpreting it as like, I don't have a choice. I live here. I manage the Mets. It doesn't matter if I like it or not. This is where I am stuck.
And then his last,
with this underperforming team.
The last thing that struck me was when he talked about what he likes about New York, he was like, they're great at driving here. Like, New Yorkers know how to merge. Which is just a hilarious compliment. Like, no New York, like, we don't drive, like, no one drives. It's like the least percentage of car owners in America. And Buck Showalter's like, I love the way they drive in this town.
Just bizarre. And to Chelsea's point earlier, like, he's just in a weird place right now. His head is in he's in a weird spot. I mean, because normally, to your point, it's like we're speed running the Buck Showalter experience. Like, his pressers, he is delivering not just words of wisdom, but like he's cracking jokes. He's making people laugh. Like, he's doing things. And in this assignment, he was not ready to give competent answers. So,
Chelsea, next time you're in town in New York, you and I, let's go grab dinner at my wife cooks. I hear it's pretty good.
Steve Buck's wife will make us dinner.
Yeah, that place is just exquisite. All right, what's their food safety rating? Is it an A or is it a B?
I hope it's a C.
That's how you know.
Do you remember the time? You remember the time my uncle took us to the C-rated restaurant on purpose?
I do. Yeah, it was delicious and questionable experience afterwards. All right. Anyway, Chelsea, Janes, before we get to your Ugla, my Ugla is also Nationals related. It is something I have started tracking over the last couple of weeks, which is that the Nationals until last night had not played an extra inning game, Chelsea. And I alerted this to our good friend Sarah Langs, and I said, hey, this seems weird. What the hell? And because I only know how to do some levels of StatHead searches and not Sarah Langs levels of research, I asked her how notable this was. And she tweeted out last night, which is, it was the fourth most games into a season a team has played its first extra inning game. The record is the 2005 Red Sox, who went 99 games before playing an extra inning game. Absolutely sensational.
Sorry. That's an amazing answer, because the 2004 Red Sox were just an extra inning game. And then the year after, they were like, no.
We can't do this. We can't do this. So, yes, 05 Red Sox 99, 02 White Sox 70, 23 Rockies. So this year, the Rockies had done it too. And then they had played two back-to-back extra inning games earlier this week, which is just bizarre. But what I want to say is, while the dream is dead to break the Red Sox record, I did want to share with the limited research that I did the record for the fewest extra inning games played in a 162 game season. Do either of you have a guess for the number? Obviously, there's no way for you to guess the team. But Chelsea, what do you think the fewest, from what I can tell, the fewest extra innings games played? It is recent, and how many those games are?
What do you think? Six, and I have no idea who.
No, there's no way you would know how. What's your guess, Jake?
I'll say four, and I will say the 2017 Marlins.
2016 Angels, and it is indeed four, which is very nicely done. So that is a record that maybe the Nationals can still take. And if you saw how those games ended the last two nights, where the first game, it looked like it was headed to extras, and then Hunter Harvey completely blew it. And then last night, it looked like the Nationals were going to win, and then Hunter Harvey blew it, and they did go to extras. So it was a very funny week tracking this very irrelevant statistic. Chelsea, we send it to you for some literal Ugla. Why don't you tell us? I'm very excited where this is going. So please, what do you got for Ugla this week?
So Dan Ugla is one of the more formative baseball players in my baseball reporting career, because I started in 2015 with the Washington Nationals. I think he was a non-roster invitee. He never wore a shirt. And so that was, you know, just something to get used to. But the Nats were like really bad early that year. They were supposed to be great. They had like all the rotation of, you know, the greatest rotation ever, whatever. And it got to April and things were going badly. They started like AJ Cole. They fell behind by like 9 or 10 runs. He was supposed to be the next big thing, clearly, like just kind of wet the bed that day. And that night, the Nats came back from, it was like the biggest deficit they'd ever had. It was the most miraculous game. It was the first game I was like on the road by myself and I had to write it. So I was like freaking out. And Dan Ugla like hit the biggest home run of the year to that date, and like a memorable one that people still talk about. He did nothing else as a Nat, but he hit that home run. And when I got back to the clubhouse, he was just there shirtless, covered in chocolate sauce, and was covering everyone else in chocolate sauce. And I, like, no one asked him why. He just said, I wanted to like use chocolate sauce. It's what we had to celebrate. So, and the kind of like punchline is, the night before that, I was really, really sick. I was like on the floor in the bathroom. I was like in bad shape. Somehow got myself to the stadium. And my night ended with Dan Ugla covered in chocolate sauce, like spraying it on everyone. And it was just like a real day in the life. My other Dan Ugla story is that he went through this crazy training for his eyes that involved like jumping on a trampoline. Like his eyes weren't synced up with his brain. It was this crazy thing. It didn't actually help him revive his career. But so I have this lasting image that I've never actually seen, but pictured of Dan Ugla jumping on a trampoline with his eyes closed, trying to catch things he can't see and, you know, save his career that way. So those are my two Dan Ugla stories. But man, he's a trip. Such a nice dude. Very friendly and very shirtless.
Unbelievable. That is an incredible story. The chocolate sauce story is so good because normally, like when, say, like somebody makes their major league debut and they do all kinds of weird stuff with them in the shower, like normally they're cleaned up by the time the media gets into the clubhouse. Like normally they try to make it look sort of normal by the time you get in there. But that was not the case in Atlanta on April 28th, 2015.
Nice. Yeah. I think Max Scherzer had like found chocolate sauce, started spraying it, and Dan Ugla was like, wipe it on me. And it's just like, all right, here we are. This, Major League Baseball.
This box score is just outstanding. Jake and I are both looking at it here. Five-hit day from Denard Span atop the order. Very impressive stuff. But yes, Dan Uggla with a massive home run late off of Jason Grilley to give the Nationals the lead in the top of the ninth in Atlanta before Drew Storen came in and closed things out. Woo! That is an incredible story, Chelsea. The best Uggla we've ever had. We'll never be able to top that. So
thank you.
Yeah, no, I've thought about, like, at some point we should probably do something Dan Uggla related, but instead we just had to wait for you to bring us the story of chocolate sauce. But one of our all-time favorites, and it's good to know that he is also delightfully weird and a very nice lad. So hope Dan Uggla's doing well wherever he's at.
That's the show. That's it. I don't really have anything else to say. Jordan and I are here in Omaha. We'll be tweeting and posting about the Collegiate World Series. Jordan, you're raising your hand. I'm going to call on you. Yes.
I just want to say, our crazy schedule this time of year does not necessarily lend itself to, like, the best version of this podcast. I think we delivered a great Barbacast here this morning. Thanks 99% to Chelsea Janes for making that possible, because I think if it was just us, we would have just been blabbering and saying things we probably shouldn't about the commissioner's press conference.
It's so funny, thank you for guiding us. Like, we get paid to do the podcast, and we do a podcast, and we spend a lot of time thinking about Major League Baseball. But maybe we should be doing that every day, right? But sometimes the way that our life works is we can't do that every, like, we are sometimes doing college baseball or little league, like, whatever. And so we still have to come on here all the time and talk to these people and pretend like we're authorities on the matter, and enough people listen that we get to keep doing it. But to the listeners, just so you know, we're peeling the curtain back. Chelsea saved our asses here. So thank you, Chelsea.
Yes, Chelsea, we hope you enjoyed it. And where can people support your work and follow you? I know you're one of the best.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, if you're so inclined, WashingtonPost.com, obviously. I think I'm Chelsea_Janes on Twitter. I don't know if I recommend that follow, but it's there. And yeah.
I think Chelsea's, it does. And I got to say, I think Chelsea's got one of the better Twitter. Like, you tweet the right amount, and that's, it helps to not be a beat writer anymore. But, like, your tweets hit. Your tweets hit. It's good. I'm in.
Chelsea James,
thank you. I mean that. That's really
Jordan and I often talk about the list of people who might like baseball more than us. This is not a definitive list of people who do like baseball more than us. It is a conversation about people who are in the conversation.
Rob Manfred,
yeah,
he's
number
way
one
up there.
Yeah, he loves it. Yeah. He's actually here in Omaha on his own dime for fun. And Chelsea is no doubt on that list. And I would say the number of people on that list that are around the game all the time is very small, because it grinds you down and it makes you hate it. And so that is why I am particularly thankful for you, Chelsea, as one, a friend, two, a colleague, and three, a voice in our game, that you have been able to maintain the level of enthusiasm that you have and the level of perspective that you bring. I think a big reason for that is that you covered politics for a couple of years, and so you're very appreciative of the world of baseball. Yeah.
100%. I would say MLB during Pride Month, it might batter that out of me, but I'm trying to hold on. Yeah.
Okay. Just a couple more weeks. Surely there won't be another embarrassing mishap over the course of the next few weeks, but hopefully not. Thank you, Chelsea, again for the insight and playing along with our, we had some good conversations, and then we got to Dan Uggla and chocolate sauce. That is this podcast. Thank you to Chelsea. Thank you to Jake. Thank you to Chris Tyler for producing, as always. We hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back on Monday. Goodbye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.